We have with us live in the studios once again, Joav Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right, lots to cover, starting with a deal the city's making about a potential arena.
A deal that the city announced. It's not really a deal quite yet.
It's a deal that is not going to happen. But you can give the details first before I deconstruct it.
Yeah, this week Mayor McGinn and County Executive Dow Constantine announced that they had a deal with San Francisco hedge fund manager Chris Hansen to build a stadium, yet another stadium in the city of Seattle. Apparently, the funding for the stadium
it's
about
an arena, actually.
Okay, yeah. Well, whatever. 60% of the funding, or about $290 million, are supposed to be put up by the private investors in the arena. And 40% of it, or $200 million, will be paid for by the city and county through a bond issue, which they say will be paid off with tax revenue from the arena itself. And but I just want to point out, too, that bonds are never, ever, ever free. Just because they think they're going to get enough tax revenue from this arena if it gets built doesn't mean that the bonds don't have an impact on the city and the county's bonding capacity. Now, any municipality or local government has a certain limit for the amount of money, just like any individual does, for the amount of money they can borrow. And if you add $200 million to that debt, you're erasing $200 million that you could borrow on your bonding capacity to use for more important infrastructure, like, for example, the $1.8 million backlog of road maintenance that the city of Seattle has. So I had this question. I looked at this and I said, well, okay, the city and county say that if they put up $200 million for this arena, that what they'll get back is tax revenue. What do the investors get? Because, you know, the $290 million they're putting down is not a charitable contribution. They're investors. They want to get something back. And so they said, well, we will collect ticket sales, luxury suites, concessions. And of course, this is a new thing for a lot of sports franchises, a new cable TV network devoted to showing the games.
And a personal seat license as well.
Yeah, and personal seat licenses, which are an enormous ripoff. In other words, people will be paying fees in order to have the right to get certain seats with their season tickets. So I looked at this and I said, well, why didn't this Chris Hansen guy who lives in San Francisco, why is he doing this in Seattle and not going to Sacramento, which has an NBA team?
And I can answer that.
Which is on the verge of perhaps losing their NBA team because the city doesn't have the money to pay for a new arena. Why didn't he go to Sacramento, which is a heck of a lot closer to San Francisco? And Jobs has an answer to that.
Yeah, well, I apologize to some of our listeners who are going into a brief foray into sports talk radio here, but it's important to understand why this deal isn't going to happen the way it was described in the news and by Mayor McGinn and various city council people and Hansen this week, and that is that Hansen gave this brief caveat, which didn't really get mentioned in a lot of the news coverage, that he and the city are not going to put the shovel into the ground until both the National Basketball Association and the National Hockey League commit to moving teams to Seattle, or to putting teams in Seattle, although neither league is in a position to do expansion, and so in both cases it means moving a team from another city. Now, to be blunt about this, this has never happened in the history of North American major men's pro sports, ever. Any of these leagues singly don't have teams move more often than once every about 5 or 6 years. Right now, the team in and when they do, multiple cities are bidding on them, including in the cases that are extant right now. There's a couple of NBA teams and one NHL team that have ownership problems, but in all those cases, there are other cities that have existing arenas that have already been built, that are ready to go, that that are also bidding for these teams and trying to offer incentives and deals to bring the teams to those cities. In the case of the Sacramento team, the ownership of the Sacramento Kings, the NBA team, is based in Las Vegas. They've already said that they don't want to move the team anywhere more than an hour away from Las Vegas. So Sacramento is the farthest north that they would go. They don't want to sell the team, and they want to move it to Anaheim, where there's already an arena that exists that has an NHL team. So it's a very, very difficult, say, in practical terms, almost impossible hurdle to get both the NBA and the NHL to move into Seattle at the same time. The other piece of this is that right now, Seattle is the largest market in North America that has only two major sports franchises, but it would be one of the smallest to have four, and it would be very, very, so you could get one team here, that's fairly plausible, but to get two when they're both winter sports, when they would be competing against each other for these networks with advertising for the TV cable networks, for the corporate suites, for ticket sales, for merchandise, etc. That's not going to be very attractive when you have other cities bidding against it. So the upshot of all this is that the condition that was laid for this deal to happen the way it was described this week is not going to be able to be met. So one of two things is going to happen when that deal falls through. Either they're going to talk about, well, we want to lure a second team here, and so we're going to have to give incentives to an owner of that team to make it more profitable for them, or we're going to have to change the nature of the deal for the building of the arena, or both. All of that is going to come out of taxpayer pockets, almost certainly. But we don't know that. We don't know what the conditions of the deal are that is realistic at this point. We just have this pie in the sky thing where you've gotten a lot of headlines this week saying no new taxes, no new taxes. And that's what's going to be stuck in people's minds when they turn around 6 months or a year from now and start talking about what new taxes can we impose.
Yeah. And you know what? Even if this deal were a realistic scenario that you didn't have new taxes, there are other types of costs that cities and counties bear when you put in a new sports arena. You get very little back economically when you build a new sports arena. That's been proved by many studies around the country. But also, there are hidden costs. For example, on game day, the city and county have to put together funding for additional transit service. That costs the taxpayers. That's a direct cost that the city and county have to bear. And nothing about this deal would ever be totally free. And you know that anytime public money is involved, nothing is ever free.
Yeah. If folks remember when the Sonics were on the verge of leaving several years ago, voters overwhelmingly in Seattle passed Referendum 91, which requires that any new arena deal be profitable to the city. So the costs that are incurred by the city have to be outweighed by the net revenue generated for the city. We still have to meet that hurdle unless city council passes a new law that supersedes it. And right now, this deal, as it's constructed, might meet that hurdle. But any deal that's realistic, the jury is still to be determined.
Yeah. In addition, there are other issues to consider here, too. Now, the city and county are saying, oh, look, this is great. It's an infrastructure project. It will help. We're in an economic downturn, et cetera, et cetera. But think for a minute. Are you going to be able to fill a sports arena during an economic downturn? Can enough people possibly afford the super high ticket prices and luxury suite prices that this arena is going to demand? And if they can't fill a new arena with bodies, then the private investors can't make the money that they wanted out of the arena, does that mean they go someplace else? Well, Job, I think you told me that on average, teams in the NBA and other sports franchises tend to move fairly often.
No, they don't.
They don't? Okay.
No, they don't move fairly often. But the thing is, again, Seattle would be one of the smallest markets to try and support four major men's teams, and it just might not pencil out to the point where it would be attractive enough for somebody to move a team here, and that gets back to Hansen's original stipulation.
Yeah, but I think in terms of moving from one arena to another, think for a minute about when we built the Kingdome, and there was a 30-year lease on it, and the team moved within 24 years. The city was stuck with that last 6 years of debt on the Kingdome that we had to pay off with no revenue coming in to offset it. Think about Key Arena.
New arenas are built relatively often.
They
have about a 15, 20-year shelf life.
Think about Key Arena, where the Sonics were very profitable, but not quite as profitable as they wanted to be because, of course, they couldn't sell the luxury box suites there. The city had renovated Key Arena and pretty much paid those costs for the team owners, and we got stuck with the debt on that. And today, Key Arena, which is still good enough, apparently, for the NBA to consider it a temporary two-year home for a team relocating to Seattle while a new arena is built, wasn't good enough for the Sonics to stay at, is now barely breaking even for the city.
All right. Let's move on.
Yes, let's.
Plenty happening in Olympia this week, starting with Governor Gregoire.
Yeah, this week Governor Gregoire signed the gay marriage bill, and of course the day she signed it, opponents filed referendum 74 to try to get it overturned at the ballot. They, of course, will need to get 120,577 signatures by June 6th in order to qualify the referendum for the ballot, and in those 90 days, no gay marriages can go forward. If, however, they fail to get the number of signatures by June 6th, well, then the Gay Marriage Act goes into law.
And people may remember when Referendum 71 went to the U.S. Supreme Court trying to hide the signatures, saying that it shouldn't be public record, and they lost that case. So when the backers of this referendum are out trying to gather signatures, that's now a public record. So there's now a new public campaign that basically outs people who are trying to sign to overturn the marriage law. It's called whosigned.org, and it's already up and running. It's a searchable database, so you can see which of your friends and neighbors and colleagues are closet homophobes.
All right. Other developments in Olympia?
Yeah, a couple bills passed this week. Let's start with the good news, maybe. Washington House passing the Reproductive Parity Act, pretty much along party lines, 52 to 46. That would require insurance companies to cover prenatal care to cover abortions. That also has the votes to pass the Washington Senate, so it looks like that will become a law in Washington State, which is something of a welcome antidote to all the contraception nonsense that's been dominating the news this week. The bad news, the Washington Senate passing overwhelmingly 46-3 a Republican-backed teacher evaluation bill that would set new benchmarks for teacher performance. This bill crafted without any input whatsoever from teachers, let alone students. It's a Republican-backed bill that was signed off on by the Democrats in exchange for votes to passing the budget this year. So it's a certain amount of horse trading by the Senate Democrats and the state legislature that basically sells out teachers and students. It's very discouraging to see that kind of horse trading at the expense of the education system. And note that we talked a few weeks ago about the Washington State Supreme Court ruling that Washington was not living up to its constitutional obligations to fund education in the state for K-12. This does nothing to address that problem of actual funding that can actually educate kids. So when the state Supreme Court goes back and looks and saying, okay, what kind of reforms are you passing in order to meet your constitutional obligations to fund education, this will not meet that test.
All right. Any other Olympia news?
That's enough for now.
Okay. Let's move on to Wenatchee.
Yakima, actually. King 5 reported this week that a factory owned by snow-kissed growers in Yakima had come under inspection by USDA inspectors who repeatedly complained to their bosses about snow-kissed packaging rotten food for sale, particularly applesauce with mold growing on it. But their bosses at the USDA did nothing, essentially told the inspectors to mind their own business. Snow-kissed, it turns out, in 2010 alone, processed more than 23,000 gallons of moldy applesauce. Most plants, of course, don't have USDA inspectors in them, but snow-kissed growers did because they sell to the National School Lunch Program. So, yes, you can imagine your son or daughter eating moldy applesauce, but not just them, because snow-kissed growers packages food for all kinds of major brands, and those products go to the major supermarket chains, so probably you and I also ate moldy applesauce. Now, Snowkist is currently under investigation by the FDA after one of the USDA inspectors got frustrated with her boss and decided to blow the whistle to the Food and Drug Administration instead. So Snowkist is no longer doing what they called recycling applesauce back into the food chain when it should be dumped into the garbage.
That's disgusting.
I know.
All right. Moving on, finally, Tacoma.
Yeah, speaking of things that were recycled, Rick Santorum is in town this week and on Monday and set up a large outdoor rally right next to Occupy Tacoma has its encampment. And so the results were rather predictable. Tacoma police tasing and arresting Occupy protesters at the Santorum rally. I suppose we should be grateful that they weren't sprayed with a frothy mix. But beyond that, you have to ask and Santorum had a lot of trouble at the rally with protesters interrupting him, chanting out, "We are the 99%, and basically making life miserable for poor Ricky. But you have to ask the question, why aren't Tea Party protesters who carry loaded guns to presidential candidates' rallies, you don't see them being tased and arrested the way the Occupy protesters were treated this week by Tacoma police. And you just have to wonder, well, why is that?
Moving on to national, starting out with a new poll this week.
Yeah, a poll by CBS New York Times this week showed that the federal directive for healthcare plans to provide birth control is extremely popular with U.S. voters, as if anyone really had to ask. 65% of respondents said that, yes, they support healthcare plans providing birth control. 59% of respondents said that they also think religious groups with healthcare plans should also provide birth control coverage. And a majority of Catholic voters agreed. And when asked about gay marriage, Catholics said that they supported it by about 44%, plus two-thirds of Catholics supported at least some recognition of gay relationships, including civil unions. But most importantly, when asked to name one issue that presidential candidates should talk about, nearly all voters said said something about the economy was the most important issue. Maybe the news media will finally get a hint.
They didn't mention IUDs?
No, they didn't mention IUDs.
How about that?
All right. Moving on, the underwear bomber.
Yeah, Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, formerly known as Robert Reed and otherwise more commonly known as the underwear bomber, and an Al-Qaeda operative, was sentenced in federal court this week to life without chance of parole. Now, the interesting thing about that is that here you have an avowed Al-Qaeda bomber, nobody's questioning that, who tried to carry out a terrorist attack, not on U.S. soil literally, but just above U.S. soil. Actually, he might have been above Canada at the time, but you get the idea. And it was done without imprisoning him in Guantanamo Bay, without military tribunals, without torture. It was done through the normal U.S. Judicial system. And so you have to ask for the several hundred people who are still in Guantanamo, some of them having been there for a decade now, none of them having had anything resembling due process. Many of them having been tortured. Many of them still believed to be actually innocent of all of the things that they are allegedly suspected of, you have to ask what's so threatening about putting them in the U.S. judicial system.
Yeah.
Of course, now none of them have cases that will be held up because so many of them have been tortured, because so much of the evidence is inadmissible, and because all of the witnesses now, the testimony is all 10 years old. But it really underscores how cowardly the U.S. government has been about using its own judicial system, which was once the envy of the world for its fairness and impartiality and commitment to the rule of law, et cetera, et cetera. We've walked away from all of that, and it's very disturbing.
I'm not sure walk is the right term. More of a...
Okay, sprint.
All right, let's move on to this week's economic news.
Yeah, this week the San Francisco County announced that they had done an audit of 400 foreclosures in San Francisco from January 2009 to November 2011. They were looking at the foreclosure files to try to see if the process of the foreclosures was fair to the people who had lost their homes. What they found was that in those files, 8% of loan servicers didn't provide notice to the homeowner before starting the eviction process, as is is required by law. 85% of those foreclosures, the documents recording the transfer of a defaulted property weren't filed properly or on time. In 45% of the foreclosures, the properties were taken back at auction by a bank or other entity that improperly claimed to be the beneficiary of the deed of trust. 6% of those foreclosures, the same deed of trust was assigned to two or more different banks or entities, meaning that the county was unsure which of those groups really had the right to foreclose on the property. And many foreclosures showed gaps in the chain of title. That's the written documentation from a former owner to the bank had completely disappeared somewhere along the line. And the San Francisco County had particularly bad things to say about MERS, the mortgage electronic registry system set up by the big banks and Fannie and Freddie in order to make it quick and easy for banks to register title and transfer properties. During the housing boom, they said that 58% of loans in there that were foreclosed on listed in their data in the MERS database showed different owners than the ones listed at the county. Overall, 84% of all foreclosures showed legal violations, and 67%, that's two-thirds of the total, had four or more legal violations in the file. And I just want to point out that filing false documents in California is a felony, and that like in Washington State, California foreclosures don't go through the court system, so no one really oversees the process. So this is an example of what's going on nationwide, and probably going on, in worse numbers in places where the downturn was particularly bad.
Yeah, so we're not talking about thousands of felonies being committed. We're talking about potentially hundreds of thousands or even millions.
Yeah, and they're not even talking about stuff that happened during the height of the mortgage frenzy in 2006, 2007, and 2008. The times that are being looked at by the federal government, you know, prosecuting banks for the types of loans that they wrote. This is the foreclosure process. Banks going after people who can't make payments on those loans that the banks were so eager to extend to them. This is just happening. It's happening today. They looked at files that were processed up to November of last year, just a couple months ago. So you know it's happening right now.
All right. Other economic news?
Yeah, this week Rick Santorum's tax returns were released to the public, and Rick Santorum's been passing himself off as this blue collar guy, you know, with his background as the son of a coal miner, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, the guy at the center of the Abramoff scandal.
Yeah, turns out he makes between $660,000 and $1.1 million per year, which puts him in the 1%. His most of his money comes from consulting fees that may have included lobbying, although of course he didn't register as a lobbyist, and you know there may be some federal law that was broken there. I think folks should look into that. He worked on behalf of healthcare companies, so he was one of the major beneficiaries of this enormous rise in insurance premiums and healthcare costs over the last 10 years. And he also did work on behalf of energy companies, particularly coal mining companies. So when he struts
in Pennsylvania, that now means fracking also.
Yeah, when he struts around saying, you know, I'm the son of a coal miner, you have to remember that he's been doing work on behalf of the mining company, not on behalf of coal miners. He also owns about $2.5 million in real estate. Most of it is rental property. So in addition to being a lobbyist and consultant, he's also been a landlord. Very definitely a member of the 1%.
All right. Well, that takes us on then to international, just about 5 minutes left, starting with Syria.
Yeah, let's talk about Syria for a minute here. The U.S. media has been demonizing the Syrian government. And this past week, the Syrian government was the target of some massive car bombs, particularly in Aleppo, the commercial capital of Syria. Last Friday, two huge car bombs went off that most experts agreed were the work of Al-Qaeda, or had the hallmarks of the work of Al-Qaeda. And then Saturday in Damascus, a Syrian general was assassinated outside of his home, which looks very much like the kinds of assassinations that have been going on in places like Iraq. The New York Times, in the middle of this past week, had this article about how, gosh, in Fallujah and Ramadi and other places in the Sunni areas of Iraq and Anbar province and around Mosul, that people are collecting a lot of money in order to buy up weapons, because there are a lot of weapons floating around in Iraq, and send them across the border to the armed resistance in Syria. Now, a lot of Americans don't know that about the Free Syrian Army. The U.S. media doesn't talk about them. They're basically the folks who have defected from Assad's government, from his military, and have set up their own armed resistance.
Just in the past 2 or 3 months.
Yeah, and the Free Syrian Army is based in Turkey. They have an open office there in Turkey. People can donate to them and everything. And the Turkish government is apparently supporting them, because this week Turkish foreign minister met with Hillary Clinton in Washington, D.C. to talk about Syria and to explore all their options. And I have an interesting quote from him. When asked by reporters what all those options could mean, he assured them, oh, yes, we're talking about humanitarian aid and diplomatic means to overthrow Assad. But he said it. At this moment, we are talking on diplomatic and humanitarian steps to be taken. But for other scenarios, we hope that those things will not be needed, but we need to think about contingencies as well. And I'm sure one of those contingencies is trying to get the U.S. to directly support the Free Syrian Army and to arm the Syrian opposition.
Yeah, you know that through back channels and third parties it's already happening. And most of their tactics, if they were being done in another country, like, say, Iran, would be considered terrorist.
Yes.
Tactics.
All right.
Just saying.
Iran and Israel.
Yeah. U.S. media coverage this week, speaking of the New York Times and NBC and CBS and the Washington Post and CNN and the Wall Street Journal, all ganging up this week to imply that not only was Iran behind a series of botched assassination attempts in the country of Georgia and in Thailand and India this week, an assertion made by the Israeli government but not backed up by anybody else at this point.
No, I think the Thai government said that the folks who blew themselves up in Thailand, they thought were drug runners, not emissaries of the Iranian government.
Yeah, but you're also seeing now a concerted media, a brand new media campaign in the United States. Well, new if you don't remember the 2002 run up to the Iraq invasion, where people are claiming that the government of Iran is not only sponsoring terror in places like this, but they could strike with terrorist strikes within U.S. soil. Particularly, several people were quoted as saying this week that various Jewish cultural centers in the United States have been warned that they could be targets of Iranian terrorism. Now, the problem with this, of course, is that Iran has no actual history of doing this, and there is no evidence, zero, none, that Iran is actually considering this, but it's part of a very concerted campaign that's being waged in the U.S. media right now to demonize Iran, even though if in any objective sense of the word, it's Iran that's being threatened by Israel and the United States rather than the other way around. And you have to ask where this is coming from, because unlike 2002, 2003, it's not being orchestrated by the Obama administration, which has been rather less eager for war with Iran than the state of Israel has been and then its allies in the U.S. has been. And you have to conclude that a lot of the pressure is coming from those allies and from the pro-Israel lobby in the U.S.
All right. Events.
Yeah, several events coming up this week. This weekend, Occupy Olympia, down in Olympia, is hosting an Occupy Solidarity Social Forum with people from Occupy movements all over the United States. To check that out and all the workshops and talks that are going on, go to OccupyOlympia.org. On Monday, February 20th, also in Olympia, there will be a rally at Sylvester Park at 10 o'clock, march to the state capitol at 11, and then a die-in and quote, creative actions in the afternoon for a campaign to help bring our billions home, to connect the cost of war to state budget cuts. That in Olympia on Monday. Also on Monday at 5:30 p.m., John Nichols of The Nation talking about his new book on the protests in Wisconsin last year. He'll be at Town Hall at 5:30. That's at 8th and Seneca near downtown. And then on Friday, February 24th, you heard her at 7:30 this morning, Holly Barker will be talking in Seattle on From Nuclear Weapons to Nuclear Energy, the U.S., the Marshall Islands, and Japan. That will be at the United Temple United Methodist Church at 43rd and 15th Northeast in the U District.
Yeah, University United. University Temple United Methodist Church.
Oh, you know, what'd I say?
I don't think it was exactly that, but you know, they put in too many words in those churches.
Yeah, it's true. It's, why can't they shorten it? Just say church.
Exactly. Well, they actually call themselves U Temple.
Yes.
Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org, and you can find all sorts of acronyms that will butcher there, as well as news, commentary, articles, all things like that.
And I've been posting articles weekly on my website, mariatomczyk.com, spelled T-O-M-C-H-I-C-K.